This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology. Are you or one of your colleagues doing great neuroscience? If so, then we encourage you to apply for the prestigious Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology, an international prize which honors young scientists for outstanding neurobiological research based on methods of molecular, cellular, systems, or organismic biology. Submissions are due June 15th. Visit science.org/Eppendorf to apply today. This is the Science Podcast for August 19th, 2022. I'm Sarah Crespi. Each week, we talk about the most interesting news and research from Science and the sister journals. First up this week, news intern Zach Slavitsky. We talk about our sun entering its middle age and what we could learn from a nearby star that seems to be a little bit further along on this journey. Also this week, we have researcher Adam Van Castren. He joins me to discuss his Science Advances paper on how much time and energy we spend chewing our food. Turns out it's not that much, but our ancestors probably spent a lot more. We have known about sunspots for centuries, and tracking their activity over time has revealed an 11-year solar cycle of sunspots or of solar activity with predictable highs and lows. But sometimes these cycles come to a stop, such as the Maunder Minimum, a 70-year period from 1645 to 1715 with little or no sunspot activity. News intern Zach Slavitsky wrote about another star undergoing such a quiet period. We're going to talk about what these solar maps might mean for our sun and other stars. Hi, Zach.
Hi, Sarah.
We should probably specify what we mean by solar activity and sunspots and what is exactly happening there on the sun that we can see, at least indirectly. Don't look at it with your eyes.
Right, exactly.
So what is a sunspot?
So sunspots are essentially holes in the sun's magnetic field, whereby the atmosphere of the sun can escape and lash out in these violent outbursts. And so when we see these dark spots speckling the sun's surface, those are indicators of solar activity.
So, Zach, where are we now in the sun's solar cycle?
We're actually approaching a new maximum in the solar cycle. This is solar cycle 25.
We're now approaching a solar maximum, basically the 25th time this solar cycle has been observed. Is there an effect on us, on planet, when the solar cycle ramps up like this?
We're more likely to see these coronal mass ejections, as they call them, or solar flares, which can occasionally impact our technology here on Earth.
But when we're talking about, is it changing the temperature or how much light we're getting? None of that is really happening.
Yes, but minimally from what we can detect. So basically, the solar cycle fluctuates with the activity of the sun, and that does have some impact on the climate that we see on Earth, but those ties are honestly pretty controversial at this point and very minuscule compared to the effects of global warming over time.
And I mentioned the Maunder Minimum. How minimal is the activity? You know, are we talking about no spots for 70 years?
It's essentially no spots. There were a few spots recorded, but at the time, there was less technology around to actually detect the sunspots.
Yeah, 1600s.
Right. Typically, we see the sun oscillate on a pretty regular 11-year cycle. But the Maunder minimum period was incredibly unusual in that it was essentially flat activity for nearly 70 years. That's definitely the biggest example of such an extended minimum period since we've started actually observing the sun with telescopes. Although astronomers do believe that similar minimum periods have happened for our sun prior to this. And they know that because aside from just watching the sunspot number go up and down, they can also use different ways to track solar activity oscillation by looking at the composition of isotopes that get locked into tree ring and ice core recordings. They actually believe that these periods have happened prior to 1645.
So we've talked about the Maunder minimum and how it may not be unique in the sun's history, but it is a very infrequent thing to happen. A period of quiet has now been spotted on another star. We've obviously been collectively staring at our own sun for thousands of years. How long have we been looking for sunspots or this kind of activity on other stars?
Our solar records for our own sun are somewhat limited in that the telescope was only invented a few hundred years ago. Obviously, when we're looking at solar activity cycles on other stars, we have much more limited observations of those. So it's really only been for the past few decades that we've been able to look at solar activity on other stars.
How can we see that activity? Is it easy to do with a telescope, the way we would look at the sun?
For our sun, the most rudimentary way to look for solar activity is by mapping the number of spots that we see on it. But these other stars are much farther away, and we can't just look at the sunspots on these other stars. So we use different measures to do that. The main thing that they're looking for in this study are chromospheric emissions. So these are essentially flares that are coming out of the atmosphere of this star. And they look at the spectra of the star, and there are specific frequencies that indicate when there are these chromospheric emissions. And so that's what they're tracing.
And they've seen regular or like cyclical versions of that for a certain amount of time, and now it's gone quiet.
For most of the younger stars that we see when we're looking out into the night sky, we see similar cycles as our sun. But for the older stars, a lot of them are actually stable. This has perplexed astronomers for a while because they've never actually seen a star undergoing this transition from cycling to flat until now, that is.
What do we know about the star where this has happened?
Yeah, so the star is named HD166620. Very beautiful name. It's about 36 light years away, and it has been witnessed to have about a 17-year cycle. It's a little bit older than our sun and a little bit colder and less active in general, but like our sun, it's about midway through its lifetime.
How did they figure out that it stopped cycling?
It's a funny story, actually. It started with Anna Baum, who at the time was an undergraduate at Pennsylvania State University. She was not looking for a Maunder minimum analog. She was doing this combination of different data sets of these 59 sun-like stars. She noticed that at one point, something funny happened to one star in particular. Essentially, it had gone from cycling over a 17-year period to being flat. But the crazy part is that this transition happened while there was a brief gap in data for about 7 years. And so Anna thought at the time that she must have done something wrong. She thought perhaps they were even looking at two different stars. But it turns out it really was just a really unfortunate coincidence.
How long was the star quiescent?
It's still quiescent, actually. And it has been since 2004, which is 18 years. The maximums would usually come every 17 years.
Okay, so it's just flatlined.
Pretty much, yeah.
Is there an expectation that it will start cycling again?
They do believe so. Of course, this could perhaps be the final transition into being totally stable activity, but the astronomers believe that this star will eventually come back out of the cycle, but they're not sure when.
Is it likely that that's what's going to happen with our sun? Is there a possibility that the Maunder minimum and some of these other quiet periods are just part of a much longer cycle?
Essentially, what they believe is happening is that stars undergo this transition, this magnetic midlife crisis, as some of them call it, going from normally cycling stars to stars with stable activity. And that sort of halfway through this period, as this transition starts happening, the stars can sort of toggle between the two states. And that's what they believe these extended quiescent periods are.
And we've kind of been emphasizing that this doesn't have a really big effect on the Earth, as far as we know. Is that also true for the final state that we're talking about?
I don't think I know the answer to that, actually. The important part, I guess, is that this transition takes billions of years. It's not like our sun is just going to suddenly stop its activity any day now. Astronomers do believe that that's where our sun is headed, to this sort of quiet state. And I imagine that having a star close to us with stable activity wouldn't have a huge impact on life on Earth. We would just have fewer what they call space weather events, which for the most part are pretty destructive to Earth. So it might actually be a good thing.
So what else can we learn from stars like these that are doing this transition, or, you know, were cycling and now we see they are stable?
The major point is that it helps solar physicists understand what's going on inside of a star. These are processes that we've only recently started studying, and it's really helpful to have an analog for the strange behavior that happened in our sun 400 years ago. But there is another cool side to this story, which is that we expect that our sun started undergoing this magnetic transition around the time that life on Earth emerged from the sea and onto land. And one of the astronomers I spoke to thinks that this might not be a coincidence, that essentially stars undergoing this transition might be most conducive to complex life emerging at the surface of planets. And that's because radiation that comes from space weather events and actively cycling stars can actually be really beneficial to life getting started, because we know that it damages DNA in a way that promotes mutations and therefore speeds up evolution. But at a certain point, it becomes a hindrance to life evolving, because these energetic space weather events are really destructive as well. And so the astronomers speculate that when they're going from actively cycling to being stable, that actually might provide the right balance of this disruptive force and also this protective force to nurture life.
Oh, so interesting. And another case of needing a Goldilocks type scenario for life to form.
Exactly.
Thanks so much, Zach.
Thanks for having me, Sarah.
Zach Savitsky is a news intern and a science journalist specializing in the physical sciences. You can find a link to the story we discussed at science.org/podcast. Stay tuned for my chat with Adam Van Casteren. We're going to talk about the energetic cost of chewing food. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology. Are you or one of your colleagues doing great neuroscience? If so, then we encourage you to apply for the prestigious Eppendorf and Science Prize for Neurobiology, an international prize which honors young scientists for outstanding neurobiological research based on methods of molecular, cellular, systems, or organismic biology. Submissions are due June 15th. Visit science.org/Eppendorf to apply today. How much of the day do you spend chewing? If you're not a gum chewer, you're probably chewing less than an hour a day. But if you look at our distant or close, however you want to think about it, relatives, the gorilla, they're chewing maybe 6 hours a day. Why are we so different? And how much time did our ancestors spend chewing? Today we have Adam Van Casteren. He wrote this week in Science Advances about the energetics of chewing and how it's likely changed over time. Hi, Adam.
Hi.
In this work, you set out to see if you could measure the cost of chewing and then how much that cost is, if it's a lot, if it's not a lot. You know, why hasn't this been done before? It seems like we really care about how much energy our bodies spend and what food, what we do with food and all that stuff.
I'm not really sure, to be honest. It's essentially because the chewing apparatus, the muscles, the jaw, the teeth are quite small in comparison to other systems that we really care a lot about, like walking or running. So I think the assumption generally was that the energy expended by the masticatory system, the feeding system in humans, just wasn't that much. And it was a little bit overlooked. This is compounded also by the fact that as kind of weird modern humans, we eat cooked foods that we've processed with tools beforehand. So we don't do as much chewing as our relatives, our ancient kind of ancestors.
It is something that researchers think about a lot when we think about our ancestors and evolution. We're often looking at jawbones and teeth from the distant past. You know, I think you say in your paper, chewing evolved 260 million years ago. What was happening before that? Was everybody just like throwing it in their mouths?
Yeah, kind of gulping it down or, you know, picking up smaller food items or anything like this. So chewing's, it evolved 260 million years ago, but that's quite a long time ago. The most proficient chewers, or the most technical chewers maybe, are the mammals. And that's because we need to get more and more energy out of our food than some other, you know, cold-blooded animals, because we have to keep this kind of fire going inside us all day.
I like the idea of being a highly technical chewer. What are some of the, you know, what are some of the pressures that force chewing to evolve?
Well, it would be dietary expansion, maybe. If you want to eat more complex foods, you can't just swallow them down because they will just pass straight through you and you won't be getting any of the extra nutrients out of them. So you need to maybe break through a protective coating, or it might be that you need to force cracks through a food to make it smaller so that the surface area is bigger and the food is broken down more efficiently, releasing more energy for you to use in your daily life. So really kind of moving into new diets or expanding diets out of the ancient diets would mean that you have to get more, you have to get into your chewing, basically.
Let's get into the details of your study. One of the things you had to do was watch people chew.
Well, I mean, we did a little bit more than just watch them, actually. So we had volunteers come into the Maastricht Medical Center in the Netherlands, and we had them in respirometry chambers, and we measured how much oxygen was consumed and carbon dioxide was produced whilst they did actions like chew different gums of different stiffness. So a very soft gum and a gum with more stiffness.
So this is a closed system, so you know how much each gas is in there. And if a person uses energy in the room, it changes the composition of the gases.
It's a closed system in that we actually put this dome that looks a bit like an astronaut's helmet over the top of them. And then we measure the gases within that smaller dome so we can get a higher precision. And this allowed us to really see, yeah, how much oxygen they consumed and how much carbon dioxide they produced. And then using some fancy equations, you can work out how much energy a certain action takes.
You mentioned that they are chewing different levels of stiffness of gum. Are these just regular gum, like Juicy Fruit or Wintergreen or something like that?
But we have to be a little bit careful. The whole idea behind getting them to chew gum was to try and eliminate the process of digestion starting. When you smell a food or you taste a food, your whole body goes into like this, yes, let's start digesting kind of drive. So your gut and your digestive system is energy hungry and will use a huge amount of energy. So we wanted to limit the impact of the kind of downstream digestion by having the volunteers chew gum bases. So they're what companies use to make chewing gums before they add the flavor or the fun stuff to it. It has no taste and no kind of smell. It's really just a substrate for you to chew. And this means that we were getting as close as possible to measuring the energetics of chewing rather than the energetics of digesting or saliva production or what have you.
And is that why you also use two different stiffnesses? So you could compare, oh, chewing harder, this harder substance, it uses more energy. And so you can kind of compare, you can kind of see that that's what's doing the work here.
That is exactly what our aim was. Yeah. So we'd have one kind of softer gum and one kind of harder, stiffer gum. And what must be remembered is that these are gums and not foods. So future work, we'd like to move into kind of like foods and things that fracture in different ways and stuff like this. But this is a foundational study. So
is this also when you were monitoring the muscles involved in chewing?
Because this was the first time that we know that anybody had been measuring the energetic cost of chewing, we were a bit worried about having EMG electrodes stuck to your masseter muscle whilst you're chewing, just in case it made the person nervous or the weight of it, you know, changed the results. So we, once they'd done the chewing study, which consisted of a good baseline of about 40 minutes of them just lying there in the hood, not doing anything, and then they would chew the first gum and then the second gum, and they were assigned a stiffness randomly in that order. And then after that, we'd give them a little break because that's a decent amount of time for before breakfast.
They're not chewing for 40 minutes, though. They're chewing for like 15.
They're not chewing for 40 minutes. Yeah, for 15 minutes. For 40 minutes, they're resting, they're watching TV, they're having a great time. And then we do the chewing bit. And then afterwards, you give them a break. And then you just ask them to do exactly the same chewing, but we attach electrode, EMG electrode, to the surface of their masseter, just on the skin. And then we just ask them to do 2 minutes of chewing either the stiff or the soft gum, just to get an idea of the muscle activation and the frequency of chewing that they were doing then.
You were able to measure energy use for chewing. Was it a lot?
It wasn't a huge amount in the grand scheme of things. I think we worked it out to be, you know, even for the stiffest of our gums, it was well below, if you chewed the average amount that a modern human chews, it was well below 1% of total energy expenditure. But what was interesting was the jump that we saw from the kind of basal rate where there's no activity going on. We saw a 10% increase from the basal rate with the soft gum, and we saw a 15% increase with the stiff gum. And as I mentioned earlier on, these are soft and stiff for gums, but they are still gums. So the inference from this is that given, you know, we look at harder foods like raw vegetables or even nuts and seeds, we might see a greater jump still.
Let's circle back to what we were talking about before, evolution and the gorillas and our ancestors. We don't spend a ton of energy now on chewing, but our ancestors weren't really processing food. They were, as we, you know, you're just talking about, eating nuts and berries and other stuff. Did they spend a lot more energy and time chomping on stuff?
We certainly know they spent a lot more time doing. We can look at our extinct relatives. If you look at the members of Pan, the chimpanzees and the bonobos, they are thought to spend about 4.5 hours a day chewing, and gorillas 6.5 hours, and orangutans, you know, again, similar to gorillas. So we can probably assume that similar things are happening to our ancestors, such as the Australopithecines, and maybe even some of the earlier members of the Homo genus will be spending much more time chewing than we do today. What I tried to illustrate in the paper is that if you took our results, and even considering that they are on quite soft chewing substrates, and stick in the kind of lengths of time that you would imagine the great apes were chewing for, you see that although this may be costing them a lot temporally, it may also be costing them some amount of energy, which is going to be detracting from the net gain from food. You know, it could be going anywhere up to like 2 or 3%.
Okay, I have a little debunking section here, which we can take or leave. A lot of people say that chewing celery...
I knew you would ask this. Everybody asked you this question.
I know. Chewing celery takes more energy than it provides to your body. Is there any way that that can be proven or disproven, you know, particularly in light of what you've done here?
So in preparation for this interview, I was timing myself chewing celery this morning.
Oh my gosh, so funny.
The short answer is no.
I knew it.
I don't think that chewing would do it. But let's unpack it a little bit more, because a stick of celery is what, 6 to 10 calories is the best estimate I could get anecdotally off the internet. It took me about 1.5 minutes to completely devour from tip to base a stick of celery. And so if we make the assumption, which is a hell of an assumption, I might add, that it takes the same amount of energy to chew our stiffest gum as it does to chew celery, then it would take about 0.22 of a kilocalorie. So that's likely to only be about 2 to 3% of the celery's energy is going to be used up on chewing. But as I keep mentioning, if we like consider that celery is a lot harder, it requires a lot more effort, it has more tough fiber than chewing gum, our estimates are probably going to be a bit conservative. So maybe we need more experiments involving celery and chewing energetics to work out this. But it's unlikely that the whole of the calories of celery are going to be taken up by chewing. They probably are taken up by the rest of the digesting of celery.
Breaking down that fiber, right?
Breaking down that fiber is tough. I can't speak for that side of the digestive system. But then think about the apes that might be, or our ancestors that might be chewing something that's similar to celery all day for 6 hours a day. And they would be losing, you know, like 3% of the net energy of their food chewing. And that seems something that I think natural selection could probably work on in the long run.
Yeah, for sure. What does this mean for the kind of processing we do to food, cooking, chapping, you know, all that kind of stuff, fermenting?
Well, we already know that cooking makes it easier to digest food, and it reduces the time that it takes to ingest food, right? Get it down your throat into your stomach. Same is to be said for processing with tools, right? If you can do a bit of cutting or bashing outside of the oral cavity, then it's going to be quicker to eat and you're going to have likely smaller particles, so it's going to digest better. And that has always been considered in like a digestive or a temporal thing. But if also we consider the energetics of chewing, we could be adding a novel element of energetics and energy consumption to the feeding system, which I think has been a little bit overlooked in the past.
Very interesting. Right. Because chewing 30 minutes a day for us is pretty low energy. But if it was 6 hours, then yeah. Cooking is saving us some energy.
And some time.
What's next for you in terms of this research? Are you looking to, you know, look at more people or different muscles or maybe even real food, not flavorless stiff gums?
I think you've hit the nail on the head there. It's moving out of the world of gums and chewing substrates in general and moving into the world of food, right? Food is a complex substrate that breaks down differently depending on its mechanical properties. So I would like to research, how mechanical properties of food influence the energy it takes to break them down. And that can be done both in the laboratory like we have, where we can control a lot of things, but also, let's get out there in the real world and try and think of ways to measure the energetic expenditure of eating in everyday peoples.
Thank you so much, Adam.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Adam Van Casteren is a postdoctoral researcher in the School of Biological Sciences at the University of Manchester. You can find a link to the Science Advances paper we discussed at science.org/podcast. And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions, write to us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. You can listen to the show on the Science website at science.org/podcast, or search for Science Magazine on any podcasting app. This show was edited and produced by Sarah Crespi, with production help from Podigy, Kevin McLean, and Megan Cantwell. Transcripts are by Scribby. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us. This week's episode is brought to you in part by Science Careers. Looking for some career advice? Wondering how to get ahead or how to strike a better work-life balance? Visit our site to read how others are doing it. Use our individual development plan tool, access topic-specific article collections, or search for an exciting new job. Science Careers, produced by Science and AAAS, is a free website full of resources to help get the most out of your career. Visit sciencecareers.org today to get started.